This is Peter Clarkson, recorded at the Bass headquarters in Cambridge by Chris Alden Lee on the 13th of October 2010. Peter Clarkson, Part 2.
Let's move on, Peter, if we can now, to the following season, which is 69-70, when you were the only geologist at Halley.
That's right, yes.
How did that come about?
Well, it was thought that, I suppose... I don't know, really. I guess that because they thought that the Shackleton Range was... the geology was virtually going to be finished by the end of my season, that they wouldn't send another geologist into Halley, I suppose. Also, of course, the Americans were providing a second flight, a second season, to complete the survey. But after that, presumably there would be no further flights, so it would be much more difficult for Bass to get a geologist into the field on his own, on its own, using its own resources of tractors and dogs. So yes, I was the last of the line.
The last of the Mohicans.
Yes.
But you spent the winter back at Halley Base, I presume.
Yes, that's right, yes.
And then you were flown out again.
Yes.
And there's a rather nice note in the logs which suggests you got on far better on your own.
Yes, I stayed with Harry Wiggins, and when we met on the ship going down, on the Pearl of Dan, when we first went down, we got on very well together, and we decided that we were going to sledge together, but of course it didn't actually work out like that the first season, but it did for the second season. So, the amazing thing was, we were together for 10 weeks, during which time we didn't see another soul. We spoke to the surveyors in the mountains, we spoke to base, so we spoke to people, but only over the radio, never saw anybody. And there was never a crossword between us, even when he ran out of cigarettes. And on one occasion, he always ran out of cigarettes. He never took enough from the depot. And on this particular occasion, I thought, oh, God, he's going to run out again. So I pinched a packet of 20 cigarettes and put them in with my kit.
Were you a non-smoker?
No, I was a pipe smoker. Anyway, he ran out on a Friday, I think it was. So I let him stew for a couple of days, because it would be about a week before we were going to get back, and he'd get some more cigarettes. And on Sunday, I said, come on, it's Sunday today, sort of peace and goodwill to all men. Here's a packet of 20 cigarettes. Air was a bit blue. Anyway, he took these and I said, now look, we're going to be back in 3 days, I think it was. So that's 7 a day and they'll last you. He smoked a lot that night. But he didn't bother. It was fine.
How is the psychology of being in the wilderness for 10 weeks like that? We're speaking... as it happens on the day when the Chilean miners are being rescued from their 10 weeks underground.
Yes.
And lots of discussion about the psychology of them. They seem fine.
Yeah.
As they pop up through the tube. How were you two?
We were fine. I don't know how, really. And I suppose, to some extent, you can say all credit to Bill Sloman. He chose both of us. And this is what I say, he made very, very few mistakes. He did make some, but very few. And I've always respected Bill for that. Very shrewd judge of character. And, we just got on well together. I think we probably had mutual respect for each other's abilities, capabilities, experience and skill. It was good.
Were you attacking virgin rock with your hammers?
Yes, yeah. And a lot of the time, it's a surveyor finds an assistant very valuable because while he's looking through the theodolite and recording angles, his assistant will be writing it all down. And they work very well together like that. It's not so easy for a geologist. A lot of the time I used to find that my assistant really had not a lot to do. So sometimes I would send them off to the next the other side of the outcrop or something, and say, you know, can you, you know, you could bring back some bits for me. And I said, I don't want anything that looks exciting. I want everything that looks dull and normal. That's what I'm interested in. And so they used to do that, but of course they fill their pockets with quartz crystals and garnets and stuff like that. Other than that, I mean, yeah, the GAs I had, Harry, and then years later, Mike Warden, they were both very good climbers, and they quite often go off on their own, and while I'm footling about around the bottom of the hill, they go and climb to the top. So,
give me a little thumbnail sketch of Harry Wiggins then, as a chap.
Very fit, outspoken, a good friend, an effective enemy, should you actually cross him, and used to like his drink. Used to have a bit too much on occasions and do outrageous things, but a good solid companion, not a scientist by any manner of means. He was a cost accountant before he came south, but a highly competent climber.
Did you witness one of these outrageous moments?
I think probably doing at least a partial strip tease on a party night on base, you know, things like that.
Rugby club stuff.
Yeah, that's the sort of thing, yes. Except for him, it was always climbing club.
There's a reference to you repairing a sledge with a geological hammer shaft.
Yeah.
Apparently you're very good at this.
Well, I was very good at it, but the bridges on the Nansen sledge did break sometimes, and we had geologists had two sizes of hammers. There was the ordinary run-of-the-mill geological hammer, then we had some, that was a 2-pound hammer I think, then we had some big 4-pound hammers, and they had a large head on them, and the shaft was about 18 inches long. Well, because wood gets so dry down in the Antarctic, we used to break shafts from time to time, and so we carried spares, and they were just the right sort of size to lash to a broken Nansen sledge bridge, so they were quite useful from that point of view.
What was radio communication like, because you were a long way from home?
From the field, you mean? The first year, it was the first season, was really, once we got the system worked out, because the inherited wisdom was that you set the aerial out one way, and that was completely the wrong way. We had a very good, he was a very good radio operator, but he was also a very good technician, and he got us right. And there were times when the conditions, radio conditions were good, we could talk with base sometimes, just like a telephone. And one occasion, it was time for the evening schedule, and very often if two parties camped together, you'd come into the same tent for the radio schedule. And it was while we were waiting for the aircraft, and all we had to do was to find out whether the base had heard that it was coming. And we called up Halley Bay's Sledge Rocks. Hello, Sledge Rocks, this is Halley Bay. Nothing to report from here, Peter. Well, there's nothing to report from here. Okay, then, see you tomorrow. Good night. A couple of minutes later, the chap came in from the other tent, and he said, I've come for the sked. We've had it. What? it was fortunate that the conditions and the communication was good when Nick had broken his leg and we needed to talk to the doctor. Mm. But they're in a little 3-watt squad call sets.
There's references to a conversation between Peter Duck and the flower pot mill at times.
When we were
Donald.
When the Americans were coming back to pick us up, they got the maps. They marked on the map where they dropped us, and it wasn't the first time. That was not a problem because we were on Recovery Glacier and they were coming in from the south and they saw us. But it was the next year when we'd set up the depot on Gordon Glacier, and anyway, they'd got the coordinates and everything like that. And when we knew from Halley that the aircraft was coming, we listened out for the aircraft, and then we called the aircraft. Bass, for some reason, used lower sideband, and the Americans used upper sideband. So it was like Donald Duck trying to talk to Mickey Mouse. It was hopeless. And we saw the aircraft coming out of the south, and it was about midnight, so it was coming out of the sun, and we saw it high up in the sky, coming over the south side of the range, heading northwards. And when it got to the middle of the range, which was a snow plateau, they suddenly turned to the right. And we tried to say to them, you know, no, turn back, you carry on. And of course they didn't understand. And the aircraft disappeared, went way down the eastern end of the range. And we said, oh, they'll be back, you know. And a few, 10, 15 minutes later, we saw the airplane coming back again, and we shouted, now, turn right now. No, they carried on, disappeared right down to the western end of the range. Then they came back again, and then they turned left and came up and landed. And when they got out, we said, what the hell are you doing? And they said, well, we didn't know where you were, and we were flying, and we saw sledge tracks, so we've been following sledge tracks. Because at that time, the only ones that would be illuminated would be the east-west ones.
Mm.
Another time, flying back to Halley, I think, yeah, this was the end of the second season, and the pilot called me up onto the flight deck, and he said, say, whereabouts is this base? So I'd come out of the dark of the inside of the airplane to this glare about at the cockpit, and I said, hang on a minute, and I looked out, and I could see all the familiar landmarks, and I said, it's right there, down there. He said, you don't say, I do say. Just put it down. And the thing was, unless you knew the layout of the base and what you were expecting to see, you could have thought that, because all the buildings were under the snow, you could have thought this was just some crevasse pattern or something. So I had some sympathy with that.
But I'm quite surprised, though, that as recently as the late 60s, early 70s, that navigation was still quite Fred Carno, still quite...
Well, they'd got inertial navigation, which wasn't terribly good always. Used to wander. And I think a lot of the time they didn't really pay enough attention to myself. You know, and of course, we marked up. It was a different crew that came back to collect us. Mm-hmm. So whether they ever saw the maps that we'd marked for the crew that had dropped us off, I don't know. McMurdo was a big place and all sorts of strange things happened. The first time, when I went back for the third season, I flew from... I wasn't the last geologist. We had two more geologists, but they didn't winter at Halley. But I went with this chap, Bob Wyeth, who was also a Durham graduate, just behind me. And... we flew from Britain to Washington, San Francisco, Honolulu, Christchurch, McMurdo, and then we were waiting at McMurdo to fly across the continent. And suddenly, one day, okay, we're on. So we get in the Hercules, take off, land at the pole, refuel the aircraft, and then we set off. And the weather report came through while we were on the ground, or just after we left the pole, and it said, lovely. So we carry on, and the weather's getting thicker and thicker and thicker, and we flew the distance, and it was just solid cloud. So we turned around and came back again, back to the pole, refuel, back to McMurdo. And it transpired that the radio operator at the pole, who sent us not the weather report from Halley, either from Hallett, which is, of course, right the other side of the Ross Sea, or from Hawaii or somewhere. and I think we actually had the head of the Met Service on board the flight, so I think a head rolled when he got back.
You obviously spent quite a bit of time being ferried around by the Americans, so you got to witness the American operation at first hand. Were there cultural differences between the way the Americans occupied the Antarctic and the way the British occupied it?
I suppose, yes, in a way. Americans, of course, like to take all their creature comforts with them, and it was quite an eye-opener to get down to McMurdo and discover that... there was a barber shop there. There were no women at that time. Barber shop. There's also a dry cleaning plant, laundrette, duty free shop. And the other thing was that you tended not to do anything by hand on an American base. You got a machine to do it. And where, of course, you've obviously heard the expression "fid power." Which does amazing things and has done for generations of FIDs. When I was at McMurdo, I got a box of kit that had been delivered, and I didn't know where it was. I tried to find out where it might be, and they said, "Oh, it'll be out on the dump, you see." So I went out to the dump and looked around, and yes, I found the box. It weighed about 100 weight, but I started to pick it up, and I was going to carry it back bit by bit. And, whoa, no, somebody saw me. So I had to wait. They came over with a forklift truck and so on and so forth. And, I just wasn't used to that.
They seem to have access to fresh fruit and fresh food rather more readily than the British base.
Oh, very much so, because...
how could they get it?
They were flying Hercules from New Zealand backwards and forwards to McMurdo all the time. And so a lot of stuff came in like that. We used to listen to their radio schedule sometimes, and I can remember listening to one party. They said, next time, on the next aircraft, we need some more steak and some more lobster tails because we've run out. You know, it's a field party, for heaven's sake. But, it was a very different style.
And in jealousy, the British FIDs were living on pemmican?
No, we weren't living on pemmican in my day, but it was meat bar, which was a lot better. But it still looked and tasted like chewed string. But I don't think so, really. In fact, when they came to Halley and they saw how we did things, they're absolutely gobsmacked, I suppose.
Was it all rather quaint?
Yes, that's the word for it. Quaint, yes.
Yeah. You got yourself a reputation for building lots of cairns. I think this might be you and Harry Wiggins.
Oh, yes.
Wherever you went, every nunatuck, every mountain.
That's right, because it was very often useful for the surveyors. If we went to an area before they did, if there was a cairn already erected, that was just usually much easier to sight on that rather than to know whereabouts on the top of the hill they should be sighting. It just so happened that the first cairn we ever erected, which we did just because that was the first time we'd reached rock, Ken Blakelock said, that saved us an awful lot of time because it was in exactly the right position. But that was pure luck. And I suppose after that, then we probably started doing it more often. But you needed to be a bit careful with cairns sometimes. Certainly a number that Harry built on top of the... of various hills that he climbed, quite often left a little packet in the top. Whereas the surveyors used to leave a cartridge case, which was the actual trig point, so to speak, and they used to cement them into the rock, but they didn't carry water, so most of the cement is yellow.
And four packet, we're not talking cigarettes here, are we?
No. Because he hadn't got any, he'd always run out.
Okay. you were sledging, obviously sledging a lot with Harry. And
yes.
And there's a reference to having to ignore the Bass handbook on when it's a good time to sledge and when it's not a good time to sledge. The weather was so poor that you had to just bend the rules.
Yes, I mean, this happened to everybody. We always said that if you followed the rule book, you'd never get anything done. You had to be... sensible in interpreting what you could do and what you couldn't do, and also with experience to realise your own limitations. You know, I remember once, it was the last season in the Shackleton Range when we had skidoos with John Wright, and we got held up on top of the escarpment of the Reed Mountains. And we'd got very little food left, and we had theoretically run out. I think we'd finished all the porridge, and we'd finished certain all the soups and so on. We weren't going to starve, but we were actually on the point of cutting down. And I looked at the map, and I said to John, "Well, if we set this compass course, in fact, we can run straight back to the depot, and we're not going to be crossing any crevasses or anything like that, almost certainly. I'm absolutely sure that is going to be quite safe." So that was what we did. We'd been held up for days with this really light, fluffy snow. And at first, it was all we could do to get the skidoo to move on its own. But then eventually we got it beat a track, and over the first half mile or so, we could pull a sledge, and eventually we got going. And we'd said to Doug Holden and Phil Marsh at the depot, we're coming, but we're going to have to navigate by compass because we can't see anything. It's white out, it's cloud. And so could you put out a line of stakes, sort of right angles to our route? Which they did for about a mile from the camp. And we ran the distance on snow all the time. There was just one point after about 8 miles or something like that where we passed a very, very small, it wasn't even an outcrop of rock, it was just surface debris of rock. And we passed very close to that. So I said to John, "Okay, we're doing fine." He was driving, I was sitting at the back with a compass on the sledge. Bloody miserable too, getting colder and colder on the sledge. But we carried on, we ran the distance, and we couldn't see anything, so we stopped. And we said, "Well, you know, we don't go on because we don't know quite where we are now." And at that point, the mist must have lifted slightly, and I looked and I could just see an outcrop in the distance, and I said, "Oh, I know what that is. That's on the corner of Fuchs Dome." And we looked around, and there was one single marker post. And I said, "Ah, that's it. That's what we want." So we looked at the compass, and then we could see the line of marker posts, and we got in. That was the last line of the posts that they'd put out. And we shouldn't have travelled in that weather, according to the book. But I knew the ground well enough that for us it was pretty safe to do so. So that's the sort of thing that happens.
Were there personality clashes that year? There's talk about problems with the people in the garage and the survey office, the year that you were base leader, commander.
Yes. we did have some problems there.
Anything you can talk about?
The people, we had two people stay for a third year, third consecutive winter. And from my point of view as the base commander, I was absolutely delighted because they were two extremely good people. They were good base members, they were good at their jobs, and they were, you know, a tremendous asset to the base. But perhaps they'd been there too long, I think, in retrospect. But one of the new people who came in, he'd been south before, and his ideas of how you service tractors and so on didn't agree with those who'd stayed on, who'd learnt their trade from Dad. Dad said, you know, you don't go out until absolutely everything's right. And you strip the machine down at the end of the season and then put it back together again. And the new chap was saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And you know, there was friction there from that point of view. That was how he'd worked when he'd been on the peninsula, but we did things differently and so on. In the survey department, when when we were going to the Shackleton Range the first time, Fuchs had taken on two new surveyors. One was a chap, he must have been in his 30s, I suppose, early 30s, and the other was early 20s, relatively young surveyor. And Fuchs didn't want to send both these two people into the field who've no Antarctic field experience. He asked Ken if he would come back. And it was thought that it would be better to send the older chap into the field rather than the younger chap. I can't remember why, but anyway. So Alan Clayton had got back. He'd done a season in the Shackleton Range. He'd got back to... No, I've got it the wrong way around. It was to send a younger chap into the field. That's right, first off. Because being younger, he'd perhaps be more adaptable and so on. So Tony True came into the field. And Alan Clayton arrived on base on the ship. And once he wasn't needed for unloading, he set about organising the survey office, which was only a normal thing to do. When Tony came back... and meeting this older man, he felt that he was being told what to do, and so on, and that really wasn't the case at all. Tony got this big chip on his shoulder, and I remember when it came to, we always used to, in the spring, we would always send out the dog teams through the hinge zone first before we sent the tractors. And the question was who should go on this dog trip. Well, I'd done it the previous year, but as base commander, I didn't feel I could do it this year. So I asked Tony if he could go, and he said, yes, if that's what you want me to do. So I said, yes, it is what I want you to do. Right. I heard later from his GA, he was desperate to do that trip. And I thought, well, that'd be a funny way of showing it. Anyway... he did his second season, and Alan then Clayton was the other surveyor who was going to do his first season in the Shackleton Range, although much of his project work had been on the map of the ice shelf. And at the end of the season, Alan Clayton was going to be the base commander for the following year. Tony had effectively finished his work. And so, although he was originally down for a 2-year contract, I suggested that he didn't stay for a second winter. I didn't actually sack him, but that was more or less what it could have amounted to that. He was a nice lad. Why he had this tremendous chip on his shoulder, I don't really know.
You're a trained geologist, not a trained psychologist, aren't you?
Oh, so yes, that's right.
How did you take to the responsibilities of man, the management in confined spaces?
We were called base commanders, but I never felt that we were.
You weren't in command?
No, we had the authority, but we were base leaders. Mm. I always felt you had to lead the people, because... I could have, if necessary, I could have sacked somebody. But if I'm going to sack them in, let's say, June or July, we've still got to live with them for another 6 months. And I just felt, I never wanted to reach that sort of situation.
But Fuchs specifically changed the name, didn't he, from leader to commander to give you the command.
Yeah.
But that didn't work in practice, in your experience?
I don't think so. It was only a change in title, as far as I was concerned. Didn't make any difference otherwise. And Derek Gipps, who was the supply officer, logistics officer for many, many years, he was a character too. And he said, I don't know what the place is coming to. He said, the base leader is now base commander and the bases are now stations. He said, the next thing is that we're going to have a station master in charge. That was Derek.
By the time you finish in the Antarctic, let's just wrap up your time down south if we can, because you you went back yet again in the late 70s to do some more work on the Shackletons.
Yes.
To kind of tidy up.
Yes.
Had you noticed any significant changes between in the 10 years between your first visit and your last one? I'm thinking of the attitude towards work and risk-taking, that kind of thing, whether things were being tightened up by then.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it was until the into the 80s, I suppose, when health and safety and other regulations were really starting to be felt down there. I remember, when would it have been, about sometime in the 90s, late 90s probably, and I telephoned Julian Parron, who was the director's assistant here, and just by way of opening the conversation, I said to Julian, oh, how are you? He said, oh, I'm fed up. Oh, what's the problem? He said, well, I've got the Halley diary here, and it's got to go up onto the website. And I've got a photograph of some lads with skidoos in the hinge zone. He said, I can't use it. I said, why not? He said, well, they're not wearing crash helmets. or one of them's not wearing a crash helmet. And if we put that up on the web and anybody sees it, we could be in trouble. He said, so I've got, the options are either don't use the photograph or send it to Roger Missing and get him to paint out the chap who hasn't got a helmet on, or else get him to paint a helmet onto him. Because he said, we'd be in trouble. And I said, well, the last thing I would want to be wearing is a crash helmet. Working on a skidoo in the hinge zone, it's such a cumbersome thing. It'd be cold there. One time we were there, and the temperature suddenly dropped to minus 40. We're out with the dogs, and God, that was really very cold. And you're probing crevasses. But I think the really big change from that point of view came in the 80s.
And then by which time you were actually with Bass on a more permanent basis.
Yes, I was, yes.
How did that come about?
Well, it's just this business of being in the right place at the right time, and your face fits. And, I mean, from that point of view, I was very lucky. I enjoyed the job, and, it was just creating difficulties for family by then. You know.
What does a senior scientific officer at Bass do all day? What was your brief when you took the post?
I don't think we really had one. You know, you're expected to do the research on the field work that you'd already done, plan field programs for the future. Once you'd reached that level, you might have a junior geologist be working with you or for you, and you'd be expected to supervise him and so on.
So were you a senior scientific officer stroke geology or stroke everything?
No, it was never stroke geology, but I mean that was all you were concerned with.
Okay.
And of course, as you moved up, you got involved with various other things like writing sections for annual reports and this sort of thing, planning field seasons. But then, you know, it's all changed since then, and the scientists, I think, apart from having to write grant applications and stuff like that, they're much more focused on the science.
Mm. Yeah, you became principal scientific, which I guess, is that one step even further removed from the actual rocks themselves?
No, not really. Well, it's not meant to be. Mm. But it does get increasingly... I found it very difficult to marry the science and the admin. You come into the office in the morning, you think, right, you get the microscope out, start looking at some telephone rings. We need a report on so-and-so now. So you stop it and you start doing the report. You get the report finished and then you think, right, now where was I? Oh, yes. But it takes you a while to think yourself back into it. And especially if, instead of just looking down the microscope, you're actually writing something. You've completely lost your train of thought and it can be very difficult. I remember Paul Whiteman once saying, it's all very well for you scientists, he said. You could be working just as hard as me when you're sitting there all day with your finger up your backside. And yeah, in a way, he was right. I mean, you could perhaps spend virtually a whole day trying to just get one page of A4 of a paper right. Whereas Paul would be flying around like a blue-arsed fly, trying to get a spare ski for the aircraft. He'd be ringing Canada, then he'd got to ring the shippers and all that sort of thing. It was a very different lifestyle, or work style, working life, for people like Paul Whiteman as compared to the scientists. You know.
You were at Bass when the Falklands conflict happened in 82, is that correct?
Yes.
You were still here.
Yes.
So you may have witnessed the change of culture about the financing of Bass after yes. the Falklands. What's your thoughts about that? A sudden influx of resources?
It was... well, initially at the time, we got all this extra money to do research in the national interest. And at the time, the geologists thought, well, that only means minerals, doesn't it? So we thought, we're going to do very well here. Dick Laws had other ideas. And I remember years later talking to him about this. And I said, you know, because we weren't party to all the discussions and so on, down that junior level, but we couldn't agree with a lot of the decisions you made at that time. And he said, no, he said, you probably couldn't, Peter, but, you know, and he explained things to me, and yes, obviously he made the right decisions. But I'll tell you something funny. In 1 year, a few years ago, I was in Buenos Aires going to join a tour ship, and I had a colleague in there from a long time in SCAR, a chap called Tito Acero, who worked in the Argentine Antarctic Institute. And I'd got in touch with him and I said, you know, I'll be there. Be nice to see you. So anyway, I called on him when I arrived and we spoke briefly and I think we had a drink and he said, you know, I'll see you tomorrow. When I met him the next morning, he said... General Leal, who's in charge of the Antarctic Direction, which was that's the political level above and physically above the institute in the same building, he said he has heard that the executive secretary of SCAR is in town and he wants to see you. Oh, Jesus, what are you going to see me for? Anyway, I'd seen this General Leal often enough at treaty meetings, but I'd never spoken to him. It was just a nodding acquaintance because he didn't speak any English, I didn't speak any Spanish. And anyway, it was at a time when SCAR was undergoing an internal review. We'd held the first meeting of the review committee here in Cambridge, and the Argentines had offered to host the second meeting. And anyway, once he explained why he wanted to see me, I thought, he doesn't want to host this meeting in the Argentine Antarctic Institute because, as he described it, in this sad old building. And he was absolutely right. And I thought, oh dear, he's looking for a way out here. So I said, okay, when we had the meeting in Cambridge, we didn't actually hold it in the Scott Polar Research Institute because they hadn't got the facilities. We held it in one of the colleges. But we just had people used to visit the institute to have tea and coffee and see around and so on. So I said, why don't you hold it next door in the Engineers Institute, which is where we held the a treaty meeting of experts a few years earlier, and then people can just visit the institute. And his sort of face lit up, and I thought, great, I've cracked this, you know. So anyway, that was fine, and everything was okay, and the sort of atmosphere relaxed a bit. And then he said to me, I understand that after the... Malvinas, the Falklands War, that Bass got a lot of extra money and you have a new building. So I said, yes, that's right. And he said, and I hear it is called the Galtieri Building. And I said, well, only unofficially. Well, he said, I think we should have another war with Britain over the Malvinas, the Falkland Islands. And this time, Argentina should be allowed to win, and then we will get a new building, and we will call it the Thatcher Building. And I suddenly felt, here's a great man. He'd actually been imprisoned in Argentina because he was outspoken of the regime, but he'd managed to survive as a general. And I thought, I've missed an awful lot here, just because we have no common language.
Was that a typical working day as a senior figure in SCAR?
That was rather unusual.
Tell me about your role at SCAR briefly. What sort of things do you find yourself being faced with?
I was an accountant. I was an editor. I was a communicator, pushing information around, and anything else that came along, really. We just had two employees in the secretariat, myself and my secretary, and that was it, really. I mean, they've only got three now. Before I started, the previous executive secretary was part-time.
This is George Hemman.
Yeah, it's George Hemman, yeah. And I used to do all sorts of stuff. And the other thing, the interesting thing, I had to reapply for my job at one stage, and one of the interview board said, one of the things I expect from the executive secretary is that he should tell us how we can improve things. And before I had a chance to answer, another one of the board, Bob Rutford from the States, who was the vice president at the time of SCAR, he said, Peter keeps telling us how we can improve things and then we don't pay any attention. And I thought, great, thanks, Bob. But it was true. And when the review committee published its recommendations, there were several of those that I'd already suggested. But the stock response was, we don't do things like that way in SCAR. I thought, I know you don't, but don't you think you perhaps ought to? You're trying to run this organisation, which now has about 30 members, in exactly the same way as it was when it was 12 members. Mm. And it's not working. But no, they'd only take it from the man in the white coat. And in fact, when the review came out, and it was one of the recommendations was that the job of executive secretary should disappear and be replaced by an executive director and an executive officer. And Bob Rutford actually said to me, are you going to apply for this job, Peter? Because at that time, I was about 58. So I got about 2 years before my NERP pension would kick in. And I said, well, if it means I'm going to be out of a job, yes. He said, no. He said, we won't get rid of you. We'll keep you on until your pension starts. And he said, this isn't a job for you. Thanks. But he was quite right. I mean, I didn't want to be executive director.
So had you kind of fallen out with him then in the end?
No. The executive director was eventually appointed, and I stayed on until I was 65 to sort of guide him through, because he came with no experience of the Antarctic at all. But he's done a very good job. He's just retired now, after 6 years in the job. And I retired when I was 65. And then my successor, whom I trained, delightful young Polish woman, she had actually been to the Antarctic. And she'd been, when she joined us, she'd been working up in Tromsø for the Norwegians. And she did about 2 years, I think, when an opportunity came to go back to Norway, where her boyfriend was living. And so she decided to take that. And she left in about March time. And I was asked, would you come back and do your old job for a few months? Which I did. Then after another, about 6 months or something, I was training another executive officer, I slipped back into retirement again.
Did you ever fall out with Bass over anything? Were you happy with the way Bass was developing and going? towards the end of your career?
No, not really. I was just finding it increasingly difficult with pressure from home about doing field work. And I was actually finding it rather difficult to get stuck into any Antarctic geology because I could feel this sort of pressure from home behind me all the time, and it was just preventing me really getting stuck into it.
But that brought you back to Cambridge. But when in your time at Cambridge, in the administration of BASS, did you ever have differences of opinion with the way things were going?
No, not seriously. Not at that time, I think. In my personal situation, it led to me looking for other jobs, and unbelievably lucky to land the job with SCAR in the same city, same line of work, unique though it may be. And
You've been back south, of course, in more recent years.
Yes.
At least five times, if not more.
Yes.
Working for the tourist industry.
That's right.
How do you find that?
I thoroughly enjoy it. I think it's great fun. But you've got to be prepared to put up with passengers, obviously. I found on every trip there's always been somebody I'd cheerfully throw overboard. And you sometimes wonder why these people actually go south. A lot, particularly some of the Americans, because it's just somewhere they've never been before, so we'll go there. You know.
Ticking the seventh continent.
Yeah, that's right. I can remember being flabbergasted seeing one chap get off the ship at Hope Bay with a green golf ball and a golf club because he wanted to strike a golf ball on the seventh continent. You know. And then I don't know what happens on these when you went on the Millennium cruise, whether you had other non-FID passengers.
We did indeed, yes. Rather large ladies from Florida.
Yeah, I mean, the questions they ask. Bob Headland collects all these questions, you know. But is this the same moon that we see in Texas?
Are you comfortable with the Antarctic tourist industry, or do you see warning signs?
No, I am comfortable with it on the whole. In fact, while I was working for SCAR, I went to one of the ARTO meetings to represent SCAR, and I was expected to give a paper of some sort, so I wrote something. Yeah, this was another example in SCAR, you see. I wrote the paper, but obviously I can't give that as a SCAR paper without it being seen by other people. So I pass it around the executive, and they say, yeah, that's fine. And because I know full well that if I say to the executive committee, I need a paper. We need a paper on such and such, you know, I'll never get anything. So I used to draft stuff that I thought was right for SCAR and give it to them. Sometimes they didn't always like all of it, but most of the time it was all right. And so we went with that. And a lot of Antarctic scientists, I think, felt that Antarctica was a place for science. Tourism had no right to be there. And I think that's the view of some of the treaty people as well. But Antarctica is just another part of this planet. And I think not only that everybody has a right to go there, or at least no group has a right to prevent other people from going there, but some of these people are really quite influential people. They come down to the Antarctic, they see it's a fantastic place, they have a good appreciation of what's going on, particularly in the science, and they go back home and they spread the word. And it's good for science. And also there's quite a bit of interaction at different times and different ways between the treaty, between the tourist companies and the scientists. Sometimes they'll take scientific expeditions down to a place where they wouldn't otherwise be able to get to. And whatever country these people are from, the national organiser is not going to take a ship there just to dump them off. So the tourists would do it. And the passengers love having these people on board because here are some real explorers, you know, who can talk to them and tell them what they do and so on. And then something that I tried to encourage, and I don't know to what extent it still goes on, but a lot of tour ships go to places where the national operators never go, and they can give all sorts of useful bathymetric data. So a lot of them at one stage were certainly collecting data and forwarding them to whoever, you know, probably the Admiralty in Taunton for the Hydrographic Office. And so, yeah, there's a lot can go back to the forwards. And the tourism that I've seen is very well managed, very well organised and administered. And it has to be said that in a number of cases, people have seen base personnel behaving with far less concern for the environment than the tourists. I don't know if that still happens, but certainly used to.
We're sitting at Bass in an office with a magnificent aerial shot of Rothera, and you were at Rothera before Rothera existed, you were saying before we started recording.
Yes.
Tell us that story.
Well, it was in 1975, and I'd just done a short season on the South Shetland Islands, and Bransfield had come and picked us up from Livingston Island, and we were stuck on the ship for, oh, I can't remember now, you know, another 3 or 4 weeks probably, going up and down the peninsula. But Ray Adie was on board, and as deputy director, if he wanted to do something, then I think Stuart Lawrence was the captain at the time. He sort of made sure that it could happen. And we had a great trip into Deception Island and went up to where the new island was from the 1967 eruption. And where else did we go? We went to Prospect Point because AD was determined that the foundation stone for the new building that was at that time being built, the original Fort Lego here on this site. He was determined that the foundation stone should come from there. So we found this huge lump of granodiorite, I think. The problem was how to get it back to the ship. Well, Prospect Point, base J, had been closed for a number of years, but there was an old sledge around the side of the building. So we managed to manhandle this onto the sledge. And then with sort of one at each corner, we got the sledge down to the launch. And onto the launch, and then when they lifted the launch up alongside the Bransfield up to deck level, the bosun Pete Crockford, wanting to prove to everybody that he was as strong as four fids who needed a sledge to carry this stone, he picked up this rock, and here he gave himself a hernia, but anyway, he got it onto the deck, and you can now see that piece of rock or part of it down in the old original reception area by Mattingley Road. And then we went down to Marguerite Bay. We went ashore at Stonington Island. The base had just been closed then. Where else did we go? We went to Rothera Point. This was where it was Adelaide. The base at base T at on Adelaide Island must have been built about 1961, I think. And the original intention was to put it at Rothera, but the sea ice was bad. They couldn't get round there, so they left it at Adelaide. And so we went to look at Rothera Point, lovely place, all covered in snow, not like that now. So yeah. You know, I'd say to people, I remember this when it was all green fields. it's having Ray Adie on board for that trip was really good value. But that was the time when a group of us were having a drink in the Fizz lounge on the Bransfield, and Adie came down from the wardroom where he'd been having dinner with the officers, and he saw a semicircle of us around the table, and somebody said, "Oh, come over, Ray, come and have a drink." So plonked a pint of beer in front of him, and he looked round the assembled company of, I don't know, cooks and GAs and all sorts, and he sort of went round and said hello to all of us in turn. Hello, Jim. Hello, Fred. And he got to me and he looked at me and he said, "And hello, Clarkson." I worked for him. He couldn't bring himself to be familiar. Mm. I have to say, all that changed in later years. As he was chairman of the Bass Club for many, many years, and I was on the committee for many, many years. And gradually we got down to first name terms, and as we did with Bunny Fuchs.
You picked up a Polar Medal.
Yes.
And more recently the MBE.
Yes.
In both cases because of the work you've done either in or connected with the Antarctic.
Yes.
And in your little biog you say that your interests these days are all things Antarctic.
Yes.
So there's ice in your blood?
Do you mean I'm cold and frigid?
No, not at all. What I mean is that there's no escape. I mean, even now you're wearing a tie with penguins and the Antarctic continent map on there, right? So,
well, it's just in case you had a camera. But I mean, this one...
I have.
This one comes from the gift shop in Stanley. It's not one of the other sort of...
I suppose my question is, can you think now, looking back over your life, what it was that... Well, we know you talked about seeing the image and wanting to go there.
And in fact... about 12 years ago, my mother and stepfather finally moved house from South London down to Somerset, something they'd been talking about doing for nearly 40 years. But anyway, I'd still got stuff in that house, and so I had to clear out. And there was a lot of childhood books there, including a 10-volume set of encyclopedias. And I thought, oh, gosh, I remember that. I haven't seen these for ages. Oh, yes. And I opened up whichever volume it was, and there were a lot of Ponting's pictures in there. And they were done not in... it was like sepia, but instead of being brown, they were blue. And I thought, yes, I remember now. I must have had these when I was about five or so.
And you're talking Arthur Mee or Encyclopaedia Britannica? Or?
No, Noon's Children's Encyclopedia, I think, something like that. Mm. 10 red volumes, and each one's about an inch thick. And they were very good encyclopedias, actually. I used to look at these an awful lot. And but it was always these pictures of the Antarctic, of Scott and Shackleton, that fascinated me. And I suppose that is actually where it all started. But I'd forgotten about it. I was thinking it all started with... Bunny's Crossing of the Continent, but no, it was actually there before then.
You were affected very early on.
Yeah, I think I was, yes. Yeah. And then, of course, going up to Iceland from school, and again, that was in 63. I went again in 64 and 66. 64 with a group from Sir John Cass College in London, because he was a schoolboy the previous year, and then he got up to Sir John Cass and was going to run an expedition to Iceland and asked me if I wanted to go along. And then again, someone from the first expedition who was not connected to our school, I think he was in some way related to Eric Radcliffe, who was the master who led it. He was now teaching at Radley College near Oxford, and he wanted to take a group of boys up to Iceland. And he'd asked me if I would go along to sort of help look after them. So I said, yes, I would. So I did three Iceland trips. And apart from the midges in Iceland, which weren't too bad on the whole, but, I felt, I like these cold places.
Mm. We've got a couple of minutes left and we must stop. Right. So let me throw one at you and just see how you respond to this. We're about 8 days away from the comprehensive spending review that the Conservative government are going to announce. And it is likely in that spending review that research will find itself being cut. If you came face to face with David Cameron and tried to talk him out of it, what would you say to him?
Well, I think one thing I would say, and this is part of my own experience here in Bass, is... take note of what Sir Philip Green has just told you about the money that is wasted in government purchasing. Because I think I saw this happen a lot, or could happen a lot within Bass, when NERC said, "Oh no, we'll do this, we'll do that," and they wanted to centralized purchasing for different things at different times, and it doesn't always work. On the face of it, yes, there are savings, but when you get down to the practical details, and I do remember one occasion when Nurk said, "We want to sit in on your interviews," and Eric Salmon was the personnel officer then. Bill had retired from it by then, I think, and they were interviewing mechanics. I mean, I wasn't on the board, I just heard about this. And after they'd interviewed everybody, Eric, who was chairman of the board, said, right, well, who are we going to choose? And the Nurk chap apparently said, well, it's obvious, you'll have to take him. He's got all these qualifications. And Eric said, not necessarily. We need somebody who we know can take an engine apart and put it back together again so that it works. It doesn't matter whether he's got the paper qualifications, it's the practical hands-on experience. That's what we need. Oh. That's the way those sort of things can go wrong. That's the reverse of what Philip Green is saying. But I mean, you know, you need to look at these things properly. And certainly I think it must be possible to save money in government. And somebody was saying to me the other day that there's never really been, we've certainly never had a minister for research and development in this country. And you can look at any number of ideas that have been discovered in this country, and we've never followed them up. They've been followed up in the rest of the world, and the rest of the world has made all the money. That's not to say, to forget, of course, we've invented games like soccer, cricket, which we've taken to the rest of the world, and they come back and they smash the hell out of us at them. But we are very good at what we do in the Antarctic. And let's hope David Cameron isn't going to cut that.
Peter, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.